Okay. Hanukkah.
Haniki.
Haniki. Vanzeldeldling.
Haniki
Von Sale Edling. Edling. Dude. Okay, I'm just going to say Dr. Haneke. Okay.
Okay. I'm Gerardo Poli.
I'm Hubert Hemstra. And this is the Vet Vault.
Before we start, just a quick reminder about our clinical podcasts. If you feel like you never get the time to sit down and read up about what's new and what's important, and you feel like your knowledge on certain topics is still stuck where it was on the day that you qualified, then you should check out our medicine, surgery, and ECC podcast series for three 20 to 30 minute podcasts where we pick the brains of world-class specialists to get the best insights, experience, and accumulated wisdom from them. Guaranteed, you'll learn something in every episode in the space that it takes you to drive to work, making you a slightly better vet than when you left home. For example, we did a series with Professor Jill Madison on the sensible use of antibiotics. And you'd think that after 20 years in practice, I'd know about the right antibiotics to use for urinary tract infections. Well, you'd be wrong. I've changed at least three things since we did that series. And the best thing is that for the most part, it's simplifying what I do, not complicating it. Go to vvn.supercast.tech for your free two-week trial.
Our guest for this episode is Dr. Haneke, who is a counseling psychologist, mediator, author, and artist, amongst other things. You will know that our goal with the Vet Vault is to help you create sustainable and thriving life around your veterinary career, which is why we loved Haneke, because her beliefs are that we can use our minds to help create our best life and find meaning even in challenging circumstances. And let's face it, even the dream of veterinary career will throw plenty of challenges your way. Her mission is to assist people in managing their physical, mental, emotional, and spiritual selves in such a way as to grow and reach their fullest potential. She is in private practice and holds workshops and talks for the public and professionals about preventative nutrition, stress, eating disorders, positive living and aging, ethics, and spiritual living. Dr. Haneke is featured regularly on television and radio and advises journalists on preventative nutrition, stress, ethics, spiritual living, and positive aging.
She started a formal training with qualifications in dietetics and then extended her education to psychology, including a master's and a doctorate in psychology. She's registered as a counseling psychologist and is also accredited as a mediator and is the author of a book called Distilled Wisdom, A Guide to Positive Living and Aging. As you can imagine, we had a lot to discuss. We cover stress, what it is, why we need it, and why it's not always bad. She gave us some highly practical tips to help us deal with periods of high stress and burnout prevention, including 6-second hugs, and a whole lot more. Gerardo, I tried a little bit of tapping.
Tapping yourself to sleep or something?
Tapping as a meditation. People who know me will know I'm skeptical about anything. As soon as we start talking energy and all that sort of stuff. But it's actually pretty cool. I don't know if it's just because it's a 10-minute mindfulness thing. I don't know if the tapping actually makes a huge difference. Do you meditate at all, G?
My gym is, I feel, is like a form of the most painful meditation you could possibly have. So I don't know if I would call that meditation, but it's very distilling and it makes you really focus on being very mindful and present on the present.
So when you're gymming, are you just focusing on what you're doing physically? Your mind's not wandering anymore?
Nah, my mind does not wander. It is literally focused on really actually just pushing the limits and battling my own want and desire to stop doing reps and to have a rest. So, yeah. I don't know if you would call that.
Yeah, I think the purists will say a formal meditation practice is sitting, because you're still thinking about other stuff. You're still thinking about the muscle movements and stuff. But I think mindfulness is the key. I think that's what I liked about the tapping. I used a couple of apps to work on having a more formal meditation practice and developing mindfulness, and this helped. It's similar. It was a nice change up again. The tapping is, I don't know if it's a distraction, but I'll carry on and give you feedback. Any listeners, give it a try. Go through that app that I've put in the show notes and let us know what you think, if it helps at all. Anyways, G, you're saying something.
I was about to just say that tapping comes up quite a lot now in the professional forums and coaching forums and personal development forums I'm involved in. So
yeah, I was doing the show notes and looked at it and went, again, I'm skeptical. And then I always check before I put anything in the show notes. I just double check. I Google it and go, well, is there any sort of evidence or support for it before we spread it to the listeners? And there's actually a lot of papers that says it does help a lot, like 40 to 60% reduction in anxiety. And so there's definitely something in it. Again, whether it is the tapping or whether it's just a different kind of a mindfulness practice, but worth a try, man. Anyways, back to Dr. Haneke. Please enjoy Dr. Haneke van Zyl Edeling. Welcome, Vet Vaulters, to another episode of The Vet Vault. And we have with us tonight a special guest, Dr. Haneke Edeling, which is such a nice Afrikaans name. Haneke, it's very hard for me not to want to switch back to Afrikaans. I don't know if I'm... Gerardo, do you think that people listening know that I'm not Australian? Do you think they've picked up on that?
I'm fairly certain they do, mate, because you're just a weirdo. You're like 100% weirdo.
Ons kan lekker in Afrikaans praat, Haneke, en dan oor Gerardo praat, en hy kan niks verstaan nie, en dan kan ons op die eerste, die wet wel...
Prove my point. Yeah, like, there's nothing Australian about what he just said there.
All right, maybe not. Maybe that won't work for most of our listeners. So just a quick background for listeners and for Gerardo, how this episode came to be. I feel like any professional project that starts with "my mom told me to do it" is probably not a great start, but that is the reality of this situation. My mom said, "Hey, listen, for your podcast and what you guys talk about in the profession about burnout and stress and everything, there's this incredible person I've come across." And like any normal child, when your mom suggests something, you go, "No, that's a stupid idea." My parents never know what the right decision is, Gerardo. You'll learn this with a lot of lies. It's probably around about the 6-7-year-old mark. Then suddenly your suggestions are not valid or not cool. But luckily, I did go and follow up with what my mom said and read about Haneke's work and what she is working on. And I thought, actually, it is a perfect fit. So for once, mom, if you're listening, you were right. So where to begin? Haneke, your work is all about stress and adaptation, and I think it dovetails really nicely with what's happening in our profession at the moment. Just as background to you, we had a pre-podcast meeting, and I explained to you that there's a lot happening in the veterinary profession, and words that come up time and time again, and maybe this is a great place to start. I'll put these words out there, and this might send us in a direction, but words like burnout, compassion fatigue, sustainability in your career, longevity of your career. What do you think when you hear those things? Is this something that you deal with a lot in your work?
It is. You know, Hubert, my background as a dietitian has kind of prepared me for looking at what happens to bodies physically when they're stressed. And then with the psychology added to that, we really can find a double barrel approach to the whole story. Mm-hmm. But specifically nowadays, stress is such a big topic. And I must say, I've been incredibly heartened by the new stress research that's really opened things up for us, because we come from a very desperate kind of a situation with stress, where people think it almost automatically leads to burnout, and that it is problematic, and that there's very little that you can do with it, and that you have to kind of suffer from the stress. And the recent work actually shows that there are so many more options, and that it isn't anywhere the stuck place that we used to think it was.
Well, I love that, because Alex and I did a live cast recently, and I talked about burnout being a mindset. Burnout being something that you can actually start believing in your head, despite the fact that you're actually potentially not even burnt out. I don't know. Is that?
Okay. I really want to respond to that. It's not a very simple answer. Mm-hmm. We know that everything that happens to us requires us to adjust. The thing that I think people don't realize is that even situations that you like, that you want, that you've been working for, can be incredibly demanding physically and emotionally. And so I work a lot with people who want to retire, and people think that they're going to have a stress-free life when they retire. It's not at all like that. And we know now that we actually need stress. But it's very apparent that how you think about the stress affects very much what the outcome is going to be. But it doesn't take away from the physical aspect of the stress. So there's this double barrel thing again. Now, just in terms of the physiology, you'll appreciate that every emotion, every hormone, every neurotransmitter needs to be manufactured from something. So all those communication products actually have to be made from some kind of a substrate. Now, the old stress research was very concerned with how bodies break down. And I want to just explain what happens. When you meet a new stressor, it's as if you're in an alert phase. And for some people, their general coping capacity tends to take a bit of a dip initially. And then it's as if you get second wind and you tap into resources, and then the coping seems somehow even better than it was before. Mm-hmm. And then we think, oh, gee, I've got this thing nailed and all is good. But behind the scenes, you are now drawing from reserve. And what happens sooner or later, that reserve, whether it is physical or emotional or spiritual or financial, that reserve gives way. Mm-hmm. And that's when you get to the breakdown place. So if one knows that that process, which we call the general adaptation syndrome, if you know that that process is going to happen, we can actually work at prolonging that coping space by making sure that you have the right quality nutrients to keep your body supplied. And then at the same time, you actually need to work on your mental understanding or your cognitive coping with whatever is happening.
I like that a lot. There's a lot to dig into. I'm torn. I want to ask, because you offhandedly said that we need stress. Let's dive into that. I want to come back to what you just said about we can extend that period before you run out, you know, when you're adapting. So let's bookmark that and come back to how we extend that period practically. But I just want to go back to that statement. We need stress. Why do we need stress? Because I know, certainly I'm guilty of, or I think most of us picture this life where things work out and we're relaxed and there's no stress because everything's in its nice little place. I know that's not really a reality for at any point in life, but why do we need stress? Why do you say that?
Hubert, can you imagine how boring that would be if everything was utterly predictable? You would probably die from that. And in fact, we see that when people retire, when suddenly everything that has kept them going and activated disappears, they implode. So that's really not what we want. But there's also a bit of a misconception. People seem to think that there ought to be some kind of a stress-free version of my life out there. It's as if what's happening to me on a daily basis ought not to be so. And maybe I don't want to feel as activated as I am by whatever is happening. I think it should be like that. So it's those shoulds and oughts that we feed ourselves that contribute hugely to the problem. Because if we understand that life brings challenges, and in fact, part of what we need is to grow through those challenges. We want to master the situation. We want to learn things. We want to grow in whatever capacity we have. I'm thinking of a painter. I mean, thinking of your dad now. Mm-hmm. The painter doesn't just start out being a master. You have to practice. There's some failures in the process. Mm-hmm. But on the whole, if you get to a place where you are sufficiently challenged and you can use your talents and your resources, it leads to a situation of flow, which is one of the best places that we need. But it's not without stress that we do that. So the whole thing of stress is actually our perception. You know that story of there's nothing either good or bad, but thinking makes it so. Mm. It's very much the case with stress. So if we think it ought not to be like that, then we're creating a problem for ourselves. If we think, okay, here comes another wave, let me surf it. So I'll become an expert surfer and I will deal with this. And then the waves are a wonderful challenge to me and I can use that adrenaline and the dopamine that is being excreted to master the situation and feel stronger and better about myself in the process.
You talked there about stress and pressure. So for me, something that I read and really resonated for me was just like people expect that there's a version of life. It's what you just said there, a version of a life where there's no stress, it's perfect, and it's like Zen or whatever the hell it looks like for them, right? Then they call that the zone of comfort. The zone of comfort is where everyone wants to get to, but it's where like you will get there and it's stagnant. And exactly. you will sit there and you feel like as if you've no purpose, you have no reason to live. But the opposite of that is potentially depending on your perception, could be the zone of stress. But if your perception is that if it's opposite the zone of comfort, it's the zone of potential, where if you put yourself in situations where you can grow, continue to evolve, continue to learn, whatever. So in my mind, the zone of potential is what I love to call the spaces where I step into, where I don't know what the fuck I'm doing and I feel uncertain and I feel stressed. That is where I learn. So stress for me becomes like this pressure test kind of thing. Hey, G, what are you going to tackle now? Can you tackle this now? Let's see what you got. I don't know.
Now, you're describing a challenge response.
Okay.
So we used to think that stress is only fight or flight. We now know that there are so many more other possibilities. So you can use that activation as a challenge where you learn, you master, you feel better. Because after all, if that's where the sense of aliveness comes from, and you know that people who do mountaineering or skydiving or even some people in the military or so, they are almost inoculated against the stress because they learn how to work it and master it. And then it becomes that place of amazing achievement where you get a thrill from the activation and you don't think, oh my goodness, I'm going to die from this process now. But if you think about it, that situation where completely nothing happens, everything is blissed out, it's closer to death than we even know. So the point is that one wants variety. And I think you need also to make sure that you remember to stock up on your reserves. So by all means, do 2 weeks of sitting by the coast. But use the time to recharge and then come back and tackle whatever is there again. So we do have to recharge and you have to stock up for whatever the next issues are. We know, for example, we used to think that in pregnancy, if the mother is stressed, it's going to be harmful for the child. They found now that those children are even more resilient from birth with some stress from the mother. Now, we're not talking massive trauma. There's a very big difference between stress and trauma. Mm-hmm. But even where the mother is busy or has to deal with certain situations, it can help the child to be more resilient and a better coper later. Same thing with our children. If we do this perfect parenting where they never have to wait and every single need is attended to and we don't ever let them fall or struggle for themselves. They don't learn to be resilient and to trust their own capacity. So there is a gradual process of mastery that we need to develop. And if you develop that from an early age, you are almost inoculated against stress. And you also learn to, for example, feel that anticipation, not as anxiety, but as excitement. So how you frame the same activation in your mind makes the situation awkward or pleasant.
Or exciting.
But exactly. I want to say that there clearly are limits. But I want to actually go back a little bit, and because I know a lot of the stuff you talk about is the physiology and the biology behind these things that we experience. So let's talk about stress. What is stress? You know, if I hear stress, I think adrenaline, cortisone, fight or flight, heart rate up. And I appreciate that it's a evolutionary adaptation for us to perform well in an acute situation of danger or we're hunting or something like that. But my previous understanding is that if that is maintained, that is deleterious. It's going to start affect you physically and emotionally. Is there a point where the reframing of it, and I love the reframing idea of it and I use it. Well, I know there is a point where it doesn't work. I can, from personal experience, I've gone through a big change in the last 6 months, well, almost a year of my life now. And I love what you said. I find it really interesting that you mentioned that good things can be stressful, which is counterintuitive. But I've totally experienced it. We had this, we wanted to move to this new state and we wanted to do this and find a new home and have this big trip across the country and a big adventure. It's all awesome stuff. And it was immensely stressful. I felt like I couldn't take any more new things. And, I would tell myself, but this is incredible. This is so exciting. And we're growing. And I know that in the long run we will. But there were stages where I felt like I actually can't do it anymore because my neck's in a knot and my stomach's in a knot and I can't sleep anymore. What's happening physiologically there that pushes you over that limit? Can you speak to that?
Well, you probably got to the end of some reserve, because when there are so many novel things to have to assimilate, it becomes incredibly demanding. So you probably ran out of some of the nutrients that your body really needs. But it also sounds that with all of the happenings, you maybe didn't sleep as much as you did before, or perhaps you didn't have time to really think about what was happening. You were just having to deal with what was happening. So one needs somehow, if you can, some balancing time where you can get your head around and you have to digest. You know, there's a whole process after a stressful event where it's as if one's head is really busy going over what happened. It's part of the deal where you have to get to the learning from what happened and you have to package the event. Otherwise, it's a little bit like having everything dumped from your shopping onto the floor and not putting it into the cupboards where you can reach it again. So just to get to that, when one is under such long-term intense pressure, whether it was something that you wanted or not, I would say the first thing that you have to pack is your B vitamins and magnesium and maybe a good stress herb like rhodiola, because that just helps your body make those neurotransmitters and the other communication molecules that you're required. Because I think too that with travel and so on, one probably doesn't eat as well as you might have done previously. There isn't enough time to really prepare food. You might have been sort of snacking on the go. There are all sorts of interfering variables that just make it difficult for your body to get what it needs at that time.
In fact, most people, when you're stressed, the first thing you do is stop cooking and eat junk food. And I'm stressed, so I'm going to load up on chips and chocolates. Or
well, yes. And I mean, a good piece of cocoa at the right time can can do miracles. But I think the general thing is to remember before any of these situations, and even during, is that your body is going to require more from you. Mm-hmm. It's a little bit like money. If you have a regular supply coming in, it's very easy to spend. If you spend more than you're getting in, there's going to be a deficit quite quickly. And we're just trying to protect the body physically. But now, in terms of the reframing or the rethink, there's another new stress management technique that for me was such a surprise. The part of the stress hormone mix is oxytocin. Now, the oxytocin is really such a wonderful, it's what Gerardo is helping the baby generate at the moment. It's that connection, that it's that comfort and safety from human contact. And so what they found is that when you are stressed and you are able to seek out human contact and consolation, your body makes more oxytocin and you deal with the stress better. It's better for your heart. It's better for your whole sense of well-being, that feeling of being connected to other people. But it also makes one kind of brave, and it wants you to protect your group and to be helpful to them. So it's one of those areas that one can actively select if you are not in mortal danger.
Sorry, I've just jumped in there. When you said that about oxytocin, it's like, because I've got a newborn now, and Lorelei.
And you're lactating.
She's like 5-6 weeks old, and we are homeless because like of a stupid mistake that we made regarding thinking that the house we're going to move into was sold and done for. But it's the whole connection of love between myself and Alex and the communication around that, and holding the newborn, and it's like it's pulled out this amazing level of like stress tolerance and resilience that I never thought I could possibly have. Because
the best
we like,
example.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah, like, and it came from just the connection. You said the word connection, and it came with a connection. It's like, yeah, no, fuck it. I have to tackle this. You know, this is what I have to go through.
But it also probably kicked up such a protective instinct for you around family and the baby. Now, the interesting thing is that a good long hug with somebody actually releases that oxytocin too. They reckon the hug needs to be at least 6 seconds.
6 seconds. Now,
at least 6 second hug. Okay. So give a good, proper bear hug to whoever is around you, if you're allowed to do that. Now, this is one of the issues where I thought this whole COVID situation was so terribly problematic, because we weren't allowed to be in contact with people. Mm-hmm. So that whole calming down, feeling good about yourself, that whole human contact thing was just taken out of the picture. And people end up being very much more distressed than they would have been otherwise, had they been able to connect with others on a physical level. Mm. But now there's a whole nother stress issue. And this is also kind of COVID related that really worried me. When one feels that your life is being threatened, and especially if these things have been going on for quite a long time, we get in some people a kind of a freeze response. Now the vets will know the freeze response very well, where the animal just kind of plays dead, and lizards and other creatures that you know better than I do often do that. Mm. But for humans, this freeze can also be on an emotional level, where people go kind of numb and they get very depressed and helpless and hopeless and can get very stuck in that place. Now, if one knows about somebody who is in that place, it's quite a challenge to get them out of there again, but the contact is one of those keys that helps to thaw that frozen place.
So what would that look like in a in a human, if you say the freeze response, clearly we're not just going to literally roll on your back. But how would some, let's say you've got a colleague or a friend, and you think, is this what's happening? What does it look like?
Is that like paralysis, decision paralysis, or is it helplessness?
Helpless, hopeless, depressed. It's a very low energy place. It would be almost like a bit of a zombie state, mm-hmm. where you would find yourself watching mindless TV, or maybe just sitting and staring for a bit, where the usual activities struggle. People will also struggle to make decisions. You think, well, why don't you just get up and do something? Yeah. But they can't. They're frozen. They struggle to do that. So if we know that, then we can make a plan to really contact. But there are other things that one can advise people to do. Want some kind of a stimulation. We get people, for example, to sleep under weighted blankets so that you get that sense of deep pressure touch.
Yep.
Even sitting in the sun helps people to just get a bit of energy back into their bodies, or a warm bath. Some of the aromatherapy oils are quite useful to just soothe and calm people down. But there are two tech applications that I want to tell you about that I think is just marvelous. The first one is called Tapping Solutions. Now, do you guys know what EFT tapping is?
No,
it's kind of like acupuncture, but it's a self-service acupuncture and without needles. So we know from acupuncture that there are certain energy meridians, and when the energy flow is blocked, there can be problems in certain organs. Certain are oversupplied and others are undersupplied, and you get whatever the fallout is from those situations. So something like acupuncture would allow the energy flow to work nicely. It's pretty much like you would have a hose pipe and you fold the thing over, nothing flows. So the acupuncture would effectively open that constriction and let whatever energy move around. Now, they found with the tapping that if you tap lightly with your two fingers on one of the meridian endpoints, you can actually get that energy flow going in the body again. It's the most wonderful thing. It's a free app, mm-hmm. and they have tapping scenarios for pretty much every stressful situation that you can think of.
You're talking about cupping. It's like where you get your hands and you kind of whack your back in certain areas when you work. Because I have a high performance coach, and he talks about cupping and capping and releasing energy. And like, I thought, it was like, oh my God, this is a crock of shit. But then when you do it, it's like, oh my God, I didn't realize that I was tense in that area.
Yes.
So what you cup your hands and you slam them against your back and stuff. Like, is that what you were talking about?
Well, it's a lot gentler than that. You would probably need someone else to do that for you. And
so if Hubert came down twice a day and did that to me, that'd be fine.
I slap
you. That sounds just brilliant. But I think you might get a bit of oxytocin going in that process as well. But
an 8-second hug as well. There we go.
Yeah, that sounds like a really good solution. The tapping was actually quite a gentle process, and there are specific little rituals that one goes through there. It's a marvelous system, and it's one of those that we can easily teach people, and it just helps to de-stress on a very personal and simple basis. Mm-hmm. The other thing that I wanted to tell you was, and this is specifically to de-stress, is around brain waves. Now, you'll appreciate that when one is very stressed, you probably are in a beta brainwave state and in a bit of a frantic beta brainwave state. There's no ways that you can relax from there easily. Mm-hmm. It's just too revved and hyped up. So what one needs to do is you need to get those brainwaves going to alpha, to theta, to delta brainwave states where you can sleep and really relax more. Mm-hmm. Now, again, when one is really very stressed, it's really difficult to do that down process for yourself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So on this app that's called Insight Timer, they have these binaural tracks that do a wonderful thing. You have to listen with headphones. And so it puts one wavelength into one ear, another wavelength in the other ear. And then your brain makes the calming brainwave. So effectively, this app meditates for you and it gets you to that relaxed state. So if you practice regularly with the app, your brain is much more able to do its own calming pathways. And so it is one of the best things since sliced bread. You can get on YouTube also a whole lot of, you would type in binaural and you get a whole lot of apps. There's a beautiful one that we often use as a power recharge at lunchtime, mm-hmm. a NASA one. A 35-minute power nap where it takes you down to theta and then brings you right back up again. And you feel like $1 million when you've done that. And especially for people who have babies and you don't sleep enough, it's really wonderful to just get that recharge because to your brain, it feels like you've slept because it's been so relaxed and then it can come back to its normal functioning. And just on that score, sleep is hugely important to help the body cope with stress. Now, it's very difficult to sleep when one is stressed, so these binaural tracks help you. But are you familiar with something called the glymphatic system?
Lymphatic?
With a G.
No.
Glymphatic.
I know, lymphatic.
To me, it was also quite new. But it's the brain's cleaning out process that stops the plaque and all of that from collecting.
Yeah.
And this only works when one has a good restorative sleep. Yeah. They reckon 6 to 8 hours at a time. And you know how foggy one feels when your sleep's disrupted or you're called out for an emergency or for a baby. It just doesn't feel right.
Mm.
And it's because that lymphatic system hasn't actually done its proper job. So the sleep is one of the serious priorities when one is stressed and to see if you can get that fixed.
I never used to think that brainwaves were a thing, right? Until about 2 years ago, I read about it and I was like, okay, you know, alpha brainwaves, beta, theta, and so forth. And I was like, when do I study the best? It's when I woke up in the morning, after a good sleep, after I've slept. I can't remember exactly the brainwaves, but it's like that's when I remembered the best.
Yes.
So that's when I was studying for my memberships in emergency and critical care. It was when the best, like the time when I wanted to study the most intense things was the time when I woke up, because that is when I was the most relaxed and just absorbed it. But then the best time when I could figure things out that I couldn't really cognitively work through in my head was when I was in the shower. In the shower, the warm, hot shower, and that was my theater. In my head, it was like, that's my theater brainwave space. And that's when, and I, as far as I remember, I think that's the right brainwave. But that's when I used to be able to like piece things together. It's like, oh my God, here it was. So I would take 20-minute hot showers to give my brain enough time and space to process the complex pathophys of head trauma or something like that.
Fantastic. So you experienced it kind of by accident. But now, just in that line, you also get tracks on these binaural programs where you can do a focus if you have to study things, or it takes you to an alpha if you have to do creative work. So you can actually assist your brain in that space. But the going down into the lower brainwaves and then coming up is incredibly useful for a quick de-stress. One of the best remedies that I know of. And then just while we're on remedies now, we were talking earlier about the activation with stress, which obviously will activate the sympathetic nervous system. Mm. Now, we want that balance from the parasympathetic nervous system. And the breathing is hugely important there. And so if the in-breath is about 4 counts and the out-breath 6 counts or longer, kicks in the parasympathetic nervous system, and one can get that calming effect that you so want. So just by doing a binaural track or two during the day, getting your breathing going, and a good hug from people who know your germs already, one can de-stress quite nicely.
Those are lovely tools for during the situation. I'm so interested in what you talked about, the oxytocin. Did you say, so it's obviously from the hugging and the physical contact. Is there an emotional connection aspect to that as well? And I'll tell you why I'm asking, because Haneke sent me a few things before, Gerardo, that I was really interesting stuff to read through. And there's one thing that really interested me called the polyvagal theory.
Yes.
Can you talk to that a little bit? I want to explore more. And it's with
quite
connection.
A new stress theory was developed by a man called Stephen Porges, and well worth looking at. And basically, the vagus nerve is the one that innervates all the organs. Mm-hmm. And when one is stressed, it's either the dorsal or the ventral vagal that gets activated. Now, the connection with people helps to activate the ventral vagus, that is the calming and the more relaxing. So we want that response. And the other is that just the soothing, calming contact from people, the eye contact, they talk about the sort of sing-songy voice like you would speak to a baby or maybe even an animal. You would get that sense of safety again. Yeah, yeah. Now, the polyvagal theory is very prominent in trauma work.
Okay.
Where we also get, when people are traumatized, they flip into that freeze response. Mm-hmm. So an instant trauma can get you into the freeze, and then the long-term trauma from something like the lockdown and all the ramifications in terms of emotions and finances and social and so on, mm-hmm. that can get people into that freeze place as well. But all of that freeze and the difficulties there can be moderated by decent human contact and a good voice. He also says even to listen to things like Disney kind of music, like a sort of sweet music, because when one is very threatened, how you hear things changes.
Okay.
So it's as if you hear things at extremes, and they play this mid-range, these mid-tones for people to calm down and feel relaxed and feel comfortable again. It would probably also really help to listen to the baby music, you know, the music that they play for babies in the womb and so on.
You're talking about Baby Shark? Baby Shark? Baby Shark? No. Okay, no. Hubert's laughing because that really hurts my soul. Don't Google Baby Shark. No. I'm sorry. I teased you there for a sec.
No,
you'll have to let me in on that joke at some point.
Oh, no, it's just the worst kid song in the world that will make you want to stab a pencil into your ear after 5 minutes. It's so annoying. but kids love it. So if you have kids in this day and age, you will come across Baby Shark, and it will be the worst day ever.
It's the worst song I've ever heard.
Now, I think the reason that this resonates with me, I think I worry that I resonate with the stuff that supports my theories or the things that I start thinking. But there were words and phrases in the articles that you send me about the polyvagal theory. And it's, to me, the things that came to mind or that grabbed my attention was that that sympathetic nervous system that regulates emotion and, as you say, heart rate and organ things is actually linked to certain facial nerves and facial expressions, and again comes back to that connection. We are, as mammals and reptiles, lack this, according to this article, you know, more basic brains. We are wired for social interaction. We respond to it. There's a term that I like. It's called the face-heart connection. And it, yeah. The reason it grabs my attention is I'm developing a theory about, specifically, and again, this is a podcast for vets, and I think a lot about the veterinary profession and what the issues are that make people unhappy as veterinarians, why so many vets hate being vets, and why we have these high burnout rates. And with interviewing all these vets over 40, 50 episodes now, and then talking to young vets and colleagues and mentees and that, people, it's such a dichotomy that I find, is that it's the biggest stressor that we deal with is clients. Our clients can really cause a lot of distress and real sadness. And you mentioned the word trauma. I listened to how you described trauma. I feel like it's, in the long run, it can be traumatic. I see so many stories where people are talking about constant complaints or this and that and that. And it's like a shell shock thing where I almost feel like it's that paralysis thing that people just go, well, I can't anymore. But then the contradiction is the vets that we interview on here, or many vets that I speak to and our friends who have thriving veterinary careers and who really enjoy their career, if you ask them what do they like about it, they'll say, well, it's the people. It's my relationships with my clients. And I feel like if you get that connection right, if you that face-heart thing, that there's a trigger there, and then it becomes an enjoyable thing because it hits those things that we are programmed for, that we're programmed for social connection, because that's, you know, evolutionary, we made to live together in groups. And I don't know, I'm rambling, but I really am starting to think that. And you talk about,
I really get where you're coming from. You know, I think if one remembers that when your client comes in, they're probably really stressed.
Yep.
So they're on the edges of that polyvagal auditory spectrum.
Yeah.
So if you speak in a calm voice and you maybe have nice music playing in your rooms, it will calm them down immediately. Now, we know that I was actually looking at this research earlier this morning where they have positive things in the environment. The one was just rolling waves. The other was a little puppy playing with an insect or some small cute object. Those things de-stress people almost immediately. Mm-hmm. So one can actually use some of these tricks to not only de-stress yourself, but even your clients. Mm-hmm. But if you just think about that, the voice, the kind of a almost like a voice that you would use for a distressed child. Mm-hmm. If you use that with your client, you'll probably get them out of that intense activation that they're worried about.
And into that feeling of safety, that feeling of I'm safe here. I can,
yes, exactly.
I can connect with you. Yeah.
And my animal is safe with you. But maybe they also just need to hold the animal. And in fact, it's one of the things that we suggest for people who can't have a lot of human contact, is to get a decent pet so that the dog can welcome you when you come home, or even if you're feeling a bit down, it'll want to play with you, or a cat that purrs on your lap or something like that, where you actually have that comfort and that safety sense from the animal that, and especially if you love the animal and care for it, that bond will probably also get the oxytocin story going.
Yeah.
Just by the way, that oxytocin is the whole setup there is called the tend and befriend response.
Okay.
So it's one of those wonderful ones that one can mindfully trigger in yourself and in other people if you care and you connect with them.
So, okay. So you can consciously activate that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So. And the other thing that you can consciously do is if you see a situation as this is a challenge and a growth opportunity rather than this is a negative and a difficult situation, it actually changes the hormones in your body. So just the mindset can change the physiology. There's a wonderful book that I want to recommend that if you're interested in this, in the new stress work, it's by a researcher called Kelly McGonigal. And she has hundreds of examples of research where they look specifically at mindset and how it affects the biochemistry. There was one not so really on the stress level, but just how when people believe that something that they are, it was a milkshake, I think, that they thought was going to be, one was high calorie and one was low calorie. Their bodies responded differently to the belief that this thing was high calorie and this one was low calorie, with different hormones and different sense of satisfaction after it, even though it was the same thing that they just labeled differently. So that expectation of outcome is very much what we can work with. And where you, if you work around what are my values in the situation and what is important for me in the situation, it changes how your body responds to the stress.
Oh, I 100% agree there. So one of the most profound TED Talks I've ever listened to was Kelly McGonigal's one about stress and perception of stress. Super powerful TED Talk, which really helped me when I was a hospital director go, you know what, you're going to deal with challenges every day. You're going to deal with stress every day. It's not the challenges and the stresses and the instances which come up. It's actually how you perceive them, how, you know, what your perception of them, which is going to make the biggest difference. And that was one of the TED Talks which made the biggest impact for me in terms of being able to cope with being.
It's a brilliant TED Talk. I think it's called The Upside of Stress. And she starts the thing by apologizing about how she used to talk to people about stress, because it was very much doom and gloom and stress going to kill you kind of deal. Mm-hmm. And this is now, no, only if you think it's going to kill you, it's going to kill you. But I still want to add in there that you need to know your physiology is affected by the stress. And if you put the right nutrients in, if you eat nicely, if you sleep well, if you drink lots of fluids, then your body is going to have an easier time coping. And that burnout time, that breakdown phase is delayed, hopefully indefinitely.
Thank you so much for sharing that stuff with us.
Well, I enjoyed being here.
I'm not quite done. if you have time, Hanneke, if you have time, please stop me if you need to get somewhere.
Yeah, I'm happy to chat.
But I do want to find out, because I love these as well, and I think a lot of it, I want to say it feels like common sense, but it's still people neglect it. There is an element of self-care and recognizing, yes, there are. You can push yourself and push yourself, but you're going to pay the price if you don't practice a little bit of self-care. And I love the mindset things about how you see it, and that's absolutely true. But then we do see the reality in our profession a lot, but in other professions as well, of burnout. Can we talk about burnout or compassion fatigue? I'm still not clear on what the difference is there. Is there a difference? But what is that then? Where is that a failure of, or you're running out of those reserves, as you say? What is it? What's happening physiologically? And are there ideas around how you prevent it or reverse
it? Definitely. Now, the very interesting thing for me is that psychologists and people who work with other living creatures talk very often about compassion fatigue, because you just get so sick of the demands made on you. Now, I know that when I have had a busier than normal schedule, and there have been many demands, I get to a place where I just wish everybody would just go away, please, and just do it quietly, because it's as if noise becomes too overwhelming and every demand feels like an intrusion. That's when you know that you're being overtaxed. Now, if that process keeps going for the longest time, you would get to that burnout breakdown phase, where there is an actual physical like damage that happens. Now, on a neurotransmitter level, that is really interesting. Okay. There's a system that was developed by a guy called Eric Braverman that I like very much. Now, he measures four important neurotransmitters. So dopamine and acetylcholine, which are on the activating side, and then GABA and serotonin, which are on the calming side. Now, everybody uses GABA up at the rate of knots when they are stressed. And when one's GABA levels go low, you feel clumsy, you're off balance, everything is loud and overwhelming. People get intensely irritable. They can get really, really anxious. So those, for me, are very much the symptoms of burnout. Now, we have questionnaires that you can do that don't require blood tests and so on, where you can see what your normal neurotransmitter levels are and what your stress situation neurotransmitter levels are. And what we find is that people who score high on the stress levels there are the ones who feel so strung out. And when you supply the nutrients to help the body make those neurotransmitters again, within 2 or 3 weeks, they're calm without serious medication. Obviously, if the stress state has gone on for a long time and the scores are wildly high, then one might need a medication in that line. But as Gerardo said just now, with exercise, sleep, with good nutrition, and I want to add with great supplements, one can very often get the neurotransmitters back into place. But one does have to take breaks where there are just no demands on you also. So be sure to schedule every now and then a week out or a weekend out. It's impossible to just keep going and think that it's not going to affect you.
I love what you said there in the end. You said a week out, a weekend out. Because quite often when we talk about having a break, having time off, it's like, we need 2 weeks because somewhere in the internet, someone said you need 10 days to decompress and time out. But for Alex and I, like 3 days every month and then maybe a week every 4 months. That's what that's a formula that works for us. It's like, it could be a weekend. It's just enough to disconnect.
Yeah. The also disconnecting from tech stuff is quite important. So just to be out in nature and not have any devices around one also helps to recharge quite nicely. I used to find for me that a week every quarter was really enough to get me going again. And I suppose it depends too on the nature of your practice. In a psychology practice, very difficult for me to be out for longer than a week at a time. And I think in a veterinary practice, you would probably find the same thing. So then you have to start arranging locums and all sorts of things that make life even more tricky. But I don't think that there is one specific formula. I think one needs to find what works for you. And in fact, this is one of the issues that I often have to remind people of, that there's so much biochemical individuality and personality individuality. Each one needs to figure what really is their own best regime.
That's like the full stop to this whole entire podcast. It's different for everyone. What works for you, discover what it is that is, try something different. Just because someone says this doesn't mean that's the right thing. And just work out what it is for you. That's powerful. Thank you so much.
Yeah.
I like that. I think to start that by recognizing your limitations, but don't limit yourself through your thoughts, but saying, all right, there is a limit and I've got to figure it out. I mean, I personally think that the solution to a lot of people's career woes in our profession is just saying, well, actually, 40 hours a week is too much for me. It doesn't allow me those breaks. It doesn't allow me the level of self-care that I need to get through these stressful situations. I can cope with these stressful situations, but maybe not at the frequency and the intensity that I'm doing.
Yeah, that all work and no play. Because I really think that there needs to be some enjoyment and some fun in there as well. But there's a lot of pressure on breadwinners, you know. And so it's very often that pressure that drives people to the point where they can't see the point anymore.
Yeah. I think that's a great place to wrap it. What do you think? Was there anything else, Haneke, that you feel is important to add? Or are you happy with what we've covered so far?
I can probably think of many more things that...
Yeah, I suppose. We could talk for...
But I'm happy with where we are at the moment.
That was so, so useful. I think it's a lot of stuff to think about. And I think just talking about it and getting people to think about it and explore more and look at some of these resources. I'll obviously put all the resources you've passed to me in our show notes. And and we might have to do a part two.
Be happy to go with a part two whenever you're ready for it.
Thank you so much, Haneke. Have a lovely, lovely night. You know those conversations that you have at conferences, back in the days when we still had big vet conferences, when people are chatting to the lecturers and asking questions, and you hear things like, "This isn't really in the books, but here's what I think." It's in those kinds of conversations that the best nuggets of wisdom appear, the nitty-gritty real-life details that you can only get from years and years of experience. And it's exactly those kinds of conversations that we try to emulate on the Vet Vault Clinical Podcasts. We don't want lectures. We want to hear about the challenges, the tips, the stuff-ups, the "this is how I do it." Go to vvn.supercast.net to join in the conversation.